new year. Excuse the mess behind me, but I am in the middle of cutting the latest edition of The Thriller Zone, now in season 2. Man, I am so excited, and I thank you so much for supporting us through the beginning of a new podcast. You know, it's not easy work. It's a one-man show right now. And but you've been so great. Your support and your encouragement has been fantastic. Now, let me get to today's show. My special guest today is none other than the legendary Ace Atkins. Man, I've been trying to get him for a long time. And he's got a new book out called Bye Bye Baby, the latest Spencer novel in the Robert B. Parker series. He's also got a new one coming out in July called The Heathens, which we won't cover today's show, but we will come back for a reprised visit, I guess we can say. Also, we'll be talking about Quinn Colson and a whole lot more. But my favorite part is when we talk about beer and bourbon and books and barbecue. So do me a favor, strap in and get ready for a fantastic interview with a guy that is about as down-to-earth and nice as they come, Mr. Ace Atkins, right here on season 2 of The Thriller Zone.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning to you.
Apologies on the delay. It's been a while since I've done any calls, so I had to update my Zoom. I had to do a little short update, so.
No worries.
Yeah.
One of our friends who like to hang outside. I like that.
Yeah. It's a nice day for a change. It's been kind of a dismal week, so it's a nice change of pace for sure.
Nice. Is that a ding on your end or my end?
That is on my end, and I'm going to try to get that damn thing off, man.
And you're in?
I'm in Oxford, Mississippi.
Oxford, yes. I'm in San Diego.
Oh, God, it's so ugly there. Just terrible, awful weather all the time.
It is kind of a shame, Ace. We put up with it, you know.
It's a tough call.
Yeah,
I actually have a nephew from Georgia who just graduated from college, and he said, screw it, I'm moving to San Diego. And he just pulled up stakes last year and moved to San Diego and is absolutely loving it. So cheers to you guys. As I'm sitting here in the dismal weather, which is probably terrible for you guys, but it's a good day for me. So cheers to that.
Cheers. Yeah, it's we just got back from Colorado Springs, Denver area, where it was unusually warm. And then we're getting ready to head back. We're like, do we go today or tomorrow? And we looked at the weather and we'd go, oh, we're going today. And just as we left, this front came in and just dumped snow and ice and everything. So
not good ski snow, like locked in your chateau kind of snow.
Yeah, no, not my chateau anyway. Yeah, and so we got back here and we're like, there are two things we said as soon as we got here. We went to visit our kids and the grandkids, which are 10 months and 3 years. Nice. And I said to Tammy, my wife, I said, I've never been so glad to have a beer and see some football in my life.
So was that the first order of business? Beer and football. That sounds
beer and cool. Football, yeah.
That's perfect. I love it.
As I said, when you start quoting the lines in that cartoon that you've seen for the 400th time, you know it's time to go.
I have kids that are out of the super young zone, and so I feel you. I know exactly how that is.
Yeah. Well, Ace Atkins, welcome to the Thriller Zone. What an honor.
Well, hey, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, I'm telling you, it has been a long time in the making. You've been a busy guy, and I appreciate you carving out some time.
My pleasure.
We are going to get to this book, which is quite a page-turner, Bye Bye Baby. It is part of the Robert B. Parker series, and we're going to get to that in a minute. But I wanted to just join in. First of all, there are going to be some of my listeners. We're celebrating our second season. We're about 7 months in.
All right.
And for those of us who are not familiar with Ace's work, we've got the New York Times bestselling series, Quinn Colson. We've got the Robert Parker Spencer series, Nick Travers series, as well as 4 standalone novels and his brilliant career. And I'm guessing, I'm going to go out on a limb here, I'm going to guess that with, 30 novels in your repertoire, nearly, you're not even close to kicking back and chilling out REAs.
You know, I'm excited about new stories that I'm working on. This is, you know, this is unfortunately is going to be the last Spencer that I write. I've done 10 of them and I've had a ball doing it. Robert Parker was one of my idols. But one of the reasons or the main catalyst for doing that is I have so many new stories that I want to tell. So it's kind of like I have a Netflix queue ready to go with all the new tales I want to do. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to getting to work in 2022 for sure.
Awesome. And speaking of Netflix and streaming and the way that we have so much more information and entertainment coming at us these days, this is a really great question or an idea that, you know, you must be, with a prolific background as you have, you must be just chock full of ideas. So how do you do that? Do you stack them up and you say, you know, this is going to be part of this series? Do you have brand new ideas that are coming along?
You know, I do keep up. Again, it is somewhat like a Netflix queue. I have ideas that really strike me as being very good novels. And, you know, some of them have worked very well for Spencer, and then certainly certain books that work very well for Quinn. A lot of that has to do with geography, you know, what books are going to be set in Boston? What's a very city urban kind of story that I want to tell for Spencer? Or is it something that's going to happen in rural America? And that's going to be something for Quinn Colson. But I'm very aware that I used to be a newspaper reporter years ago. I worked in Florida. And so I'm always looking for good stories coming down the wire. You know, you know, just to make a note of them, I just keep them in the queue and I organize them and I put the top ones I want to work on. So I kind of know right now what's the 1, 2, 3, what am I really passionate about? You know, because that story is going to be the thing that's going to bring readers in. And hopefully, you know, what I've tried to take pride in with Spencer is not just writing a Spencer novel. Mr. Parker had written 39 books before he passed away with Spencer. And, you know, the whole reason I was hired was to bring new stories to the table for those wonderful characters that he created. And, you know, hopefully that's what I've done. I'm getting out at 10 books that I've written, and overall it'll be, there was another book that was partly written by Parker and partly by his agent, but there's going to be 50 overall. So I figured that what a milestone for that character. And so I've been very pleased to be a part of it.
Well, and you know what, you've had the perfect background. When people say to me, and I've heard other discussions, whether it's a Thriller Fest, wherever, and people go, oh, where do you get your ideas? And I'm like, I'm always thinking to myself, pick up the newspaper, watch the news headlines. I mean, they're just there one after the other. And I'm not talking about stealing an idea wholesale. I'm talking about take a germ of an idea and go tag the classic what if, and go from there. And with your background, you had it all around you, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. And there's no doubt. I mean, I used to cover the police beat. That was my main thing. I certainly spent a decent amount of time in the courthouse and seeing interesting trials that took place. It used to be my everyday when I was right out of college. Best part of the day was getting up in the morning, getting a big cup of coffee on the street, being in downtown Tampa, and going to the police station and talking to the desk sergeant and the communications director and the detectives who are coming through, you know, hunting for a good story. And that's what my training is what is a good story? What's going to motivate that? And I think that, you know, even though you have a character like Spencer, who's such an iconic character and such one of the greatest private eyes in history, you know, up there with Philip Marlowe and Sam Spade, he's one of our great detectives. He's got to have a good case and he's got to have something interesting to do. And so, yeah, I am always fishing for ideas, and I'm not fishing for ideas in other novels. I'm not inspired by, I read this one story, this story in another book. It doesn't translate. But when you see something that's happened in real life, something that's happened in your own community, that's where everything happens, whether it's Spencer or whether it's Quinn or whether it's one of the true crime novels I've written. It's all coming from real life.
Well, and it keeps it real. And, you know, it's, you know, people always say that there aren't any original ideas, that everything's been done, but I don't know. I always believe that, there's always a flavor or an angle. I mean, again, you take an ordinary right out of the headlines and just turn a twist on it and you've got a whole new story. Like in Bye Bye Baby, which we'll talk about in a minute. Sure. You know, when I first started reading, I was like, oh, this is right. Wait, no, that's not exactly right out of it, but it's pretty close to what we just saw. And, you know, it goes back to my thinking too. There's plenty of room for everybody. You know, we get a little bit, afraid of that daunting, well, there's so many books out there, and but there's always going to be somebody who wants that little Spencer flair or that Quinn flair, or, you know, it's plenty of room for everybody.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that it's, you know, if the characters resonate with people, is the story intriguing? That does it draw you in? And it's a lot harder. It's a lot harder than it looks. You know, it's like with Spencer, you know, the genius of Bob Parker that showed me the way, you know, with 39 books and the other novels that he had written, and he made it look so damn easy. I mean, there's just, when you pick up a Parker novel, you think, oh my gosh, this is so simple. And that was the genius of Parker, is he made it look easy. And he was like Parker was like a great athlete. You know, you see a guy stepping up to the plate and you say, oh geez, I could do that. You know, so every guy in America sitting down, swilling beer and go, oh, I could be one of those guys in the NFL or Major League Baseball. I could do that. But the great ones make it look easy. And he was one of the great ones. And not only did I learn a lot from Parker before I started writing Spencer, I learned a lot from so much about Spencer writing Spencer. And so this has been like a master class, being able to really dissect those novels and see how he did things. And there's a reason why that character is so popular 50 years on. Not a lot of characters have that kind of longevity.
No, I can't think of many, you know. And it makes me wonder, with that journalism background, were you daydreaming about being a writer during that period? Was it further back in college? Was it even further back? I mean, when did you decide that, you know what, that right there, full-time guy, that's what I want?
Do you know, I have to admit, I did from a very, you know, you ask kids about their career and what an unusual career that I had chosen. And I was an athlete in high school and in college, but that was never really my dream. I mean, that was something I did. That was part of, you know, how I paid for school, and I was glad to be part of it. But my dream was always, you know, I loved going to a bookstore. I loved going back in those old days, going to a used paperback store and seeing Robert Parker on the shelf and finding, you know, it was harder to find books back then, you know, 25 years ago. It wasn't like now you could just, you know, order something online. I mean, if you were looking for, you know, an early Parker book, you had to go to the old paperback store and go find it and search it out. So that's what I wanted to do. You know, John D. McDonald, I was very fortunate to know Elmore Leonard, and he became a good friend of mine. And I was just, he was one of my heroes. And so that's what I wanted to do. That was the career that I wanted to have. So I knew that certainly probably going back to high school, in college, and then the question of how do you do that? You know, how does that really translate? You know, you don't put in a resume to become a crime writer. And I think what I was really lacking, I knew the kind of stories I wanted to tell, but I didn't have good stories. You know, I didn't have the life experience that Parker had. I didn't have the life experience that John D. McDonald had. So I really fell into it, but that's why I became a reporter. And that's why I wanted to be on the crime beat, is to collect those experiences, to collect those stories, to hang out in the, you know, the police department, to hang out at the jail, to do jailhouse interviews, meeting people. I don't think you can write authentically if you haven't been around that world. And I was so damn fortunate to be a part of that. And it's everything I do since that time. I have not been a full-time journalist since 2001. But that experience I had during those years was just absolutely invaluable.
Okay, well, I got to admit, I'm a little distracted because you were former friends with one of my absolute heroes. How did you get to know and befriend Elmore Leonard, for crying out loud?
Well, it's a good story. I'm glad you asked that, because it, you know, it's something that it sounds unbelievable. I got to know Elmore Leonard when I was in France. We were both on a book tour, book promotional tour, and also hitting some a book festival that was in the south of France. I know this sounds just unbelievable. And he and his wife were there, and we spent time on the train together and at the, you know, doing these press junkets. And it's so unusual in France when you do promotion for a book, because people love writers. I mean, writers are much bigger celebrities than they are in America. And so when Elmore Leonard got off the train in the south of France, there was media meeting him there, and pictures and flashbulbs going off and whatever. I mean, he was such a hero, wonderful man. And we ended up striking up a correspondence, and he was very old school. So we did not email, we exchanged letters. And so I have some very treasured letters that came from him that were, you know, typed out And he would send these, he was very generous. I was very young when I met him. I was still out of my 20s. And I think he knew that I was very serious about making this a career and could not have been more generous and more honest with his evaluation of my work. And I learned a lot from him. So he is one of the all-time greats and will always be, you know, one of the greatest crime writers ever.
Wow, that is so fantastic. You know, and so many questions come to mind. I'll try to keep them real pointed. Did you find yourself, because he has such a specific style, such a terse and tight style in both the Westerns and the more modern adaptations of stories, did you find yourself wanting to borrow a little bit of that, or did you take an essence of perhaps some of his instructions, since he was so generous with that, and incorporate it into your writing?
I think one of the biggest things about his work that is so impressive is you don't notice him writing. Right. You don't notice him writing. And I think that there are many writers that you celebrate and you go, my God, what a sentence, and what a, you know, florid over the top of the sunset and the moon and the stars and the, you know, all that stuff. And I just thought that was just a bunch of bag of tricks. And it was unnecessary. And the whole thing was to immerse you into the novel and not to fall back on those writer tricks that a lot of writers really get pats on the back for being over the top. So what he taught me to do, and from reading my early novels, and he was generous enough to give blurbs, but I also on the side said, okay, all right, Mr. Leonard, you know, I never called him Dutch or anything. I just called him Mr. Leonard. I said, what did you really think? And he said, well, I think you should do this. I think you should do that. But it mainly was his effortless style and the way you just did not even notice he was writing. And it goes back to one of his great rules of writing, which I always, anytime that I teach a creative fiction class or whatever, I pull out the Elmore Leonard rules of writing, which is, if it looks like writing, take it out. And it's hard to understand that, but after a while, I finally got it. And I think about that every day I sit down at the keyboard.
Well, and I have to admit, the Bye Bye Baby, Parker in general, really kind of personifies that. And I haven't read tons of Parker. I probably read some of the early ones. But that's one of the things I so enjoy. And it's so funny, you're making me think of something, Ace. I had Meg Gardner, not to drop a name, but I had Meg on an early show. And I love Meg's style. And
yeah, she's a very good friend of mine. She's wonderful.
Oh, I adore her. And she has such a, if I use the word floral, it sounds a little off the center, but she has such a command of the English language. And I have often said to her, I'm like, babe, how in the world did you get that sentence with that word and so forth, which I love. And then I get to Spencer and Bye Bye Baby. And I'm just going, tin, tin. And, you know, the pages are just doing this. And I'm so lost in the story and the lack of florid mechanics that I just, the book is over and you're like, oh, geez, where did that go? So.
And I think that it's two different, very different ways of storytelling. Meg is one of my favorite crime writers working today. She is outstanding. One of the smartest people in the business, a wonderful writer, and comes up with some of the most inventive storytelling. I love her books. You know, Parker, the way that the books, you know, flow and read is very much a Parker type thing. And it's a very unusual thing. When I sit down, you'll see a lot more influence in Elmore Leonard with my Quinn Coulson books. The Quinn Coulson books are absolutely me and my style and the way that I write and the way I want to tell a story. But when I'm writing a Spencer book, I have the added layer of difficulty, which I'm writing it as the way Parker would have written this book. I'm not writing this. I'm not trying to put my own stamp on a Spencer book and saying, wow, that Ace Atkins, he changed up the way Spencer was done. The best compliment that I ever get from readers is there was a seamless transition into the new books. And it felt like after Bob wrote the book Six Kill, we rolled right into Lullaby. And there was not a change of business. There was not a change. It felt. And so that's really what I wanted to accomplish. So I look at things very differently when I'm writing, you know, I say my own books, but they are, you know, when I'm writing a Quinn Coulson book, that is my own book. You know, no matter what I do when I'm writing a Spencer book, it's still Bob's book. And it's really, it is, I would never write for anybody else. I would ever never have any interest in writing for another author. I just love the Spencer character, and it's just been a blast writing that thing. But I really come to it again with the added level of difficulty or layer of difficulty, which is to write it as Bob would have written. Use the words Bob would have written, the pacing Bob would have used, all those kind of details.
Well, so many questions are racing to my mind, so I'm going to get right to it. Do you recall the first Robert B. Parker book you read, and was it well prior to your being approached by his estate to carry on the torch?
Absolutely. I mean, Bob Parker was the catalyst for me wanting to become a crime writer, really wanting to become a novelist. So I read, I think it was, I'm trying to think, one of his mid, you know, early 80s books, maybe it was Ceremony. I can't remember. And I really enjoyed it, but I felt like there was a back story that I wasn't getting. And so I went back to the beginning, and I'm kind of a completist. I like to read everything. You know, if I'm reading Ian Fleming, I want to start back at Casino Royale. I want to read everything and see the whole story. And Bob's story with Spencer is not necessarily a long arc. You know, usually the books are very self-contained, but you certainly gain a lot of knowledge about that character going back to the beginning. So again, I went back to a secondhand bookshop. I think at that time it may have been out of print or at least hard to find. Got a copy of Godwolf Manuscript, the original novel that was published almost 50 years ago now, and started that. And I just, oh my God, that novel just blew me away. And I said, this is what I want to do. This is the kind of story that I want to write. This is what I want to get into. And it led me to, you know, becoming a crime reporter and hanging out with cops and, you know, the crime beat, and then writing detective stories. And it was funny, Parker really, it wasn't the other way around. Parker led me to Hammett and Chandler. You know, I read Parker before I read Hammett and Chandler. And then I read those guys that had influenced him and the whole story of the great American detective novel. So, you know, we're going back to when I was a teenager, reading these books. Wow. And it was just to be able to come back around into my career and then to be able to write that character has been a thrill.
Well, you know, much of my audience is made up of both established authors, whether it's traditional or self-published. But for those of whom have no idea what it's like, because I try to, when I was studying up on you, I was like, what would it be like? And this is, and you've kind of referenced it, but I want to see if I can get one more step specific. Can you share what it's like to step into and write as another author? You're not just borrowing cadence and minimalism. You're doing more, because have you ever acted, by the way, in school or?
No, but I've been around that world. So I know, yes, I have very good friends that are, I have friends that are actors that I like them so much, I would never become an actor because I see the talent that they have.
Okay. So the point being, you know, a good actor can become this other character that they are not, and they do it with reckless abandon, no seams. You don't see it happening like the De Niro's and so forth. So I'm kind of wondering if it's anything like that to write as someone else.
I think it is. No, for sure. And I think that's a really terrific analogy. That's exactly when I am writing in the voice and the style and the manner of Robert Parker. Again, from day one, you know, I never had the idea of I'm going to put my personal stamp on this. I'm going to change the way. Nobody wants to see that. People want to see Spencer continue. And the books are first person, so you do have to get into that character. Of course, the joy of writing this character is that character has been so much a part of my life that I started that almost immediately. I remember when I was asked if I would contribute some pages to possibly starting to write Spencer, the editor, Chris Pepe, who had been Parker's editor for 20 odd years or more, Chris said, you know, at this time I was already established crime writer. She said, do you want me to send you a box of Bob's books so you can get used to the style and what he wrote about? And I said, Chris, I said, I've been reading his books since I was a kid. And I said, I have every one of them on my shelf, first editions. I said, I'm not only a Parker fan, I'm a completist as far as a book collector. I said, she said, well, when can you start? I said, I know that character so well, I can start tomorrow. And so there's so much about that character as I grew up that, you know, our lives are very similar. You know, I know what it's, you know, we like to, you know, we like to drink beer. We like to, you know, work out. You know, I like to, you know, I like to watch baseball. I like, you know, all those things that are very, you know, I know what it's like as a reporter to investigate cases. I know what it's like to run into, you know, issues trying to get to the truth of something with the police and all that kind of stuff. So I felt like over the years that character has really influenced me, not only as a writer, as a person. So, but certainly as I'm writing that, when I am writing a Spencer book, I do get into character, and it is very similar to an actor, I think, getting into a role.
Here's a great question that would be part of my rapid fire, which usually wraps up the show. And how, what is your process like? And I don't know why all writers want to ask other writers their process. It's probably the same way with sports or actors. But do you like, because you triggered my thinking when you said get into character, do you like to go into solitude? Do you demand solitude and silence? Or do you like, can you go to do the coffee shop thing with all the atmosphere and the noise and listen to music, et cetera?
I think for me, coming out of, again, the training in the newsroom is not exactly a holy, you know, you know,
it's not a library,
where, you know, soundproof void, you know, and I think that I had to train myself to listen to a lot of noise. So I know that years ago I had rented an office that was out in the country here. And it was so quiet at some point that I was working. This was like 10 or so years ago. I could hear the wind blowing around the buildings. It was just so quiet. And I couldn't write. It was just too quiet. And I ended up even paying the rent for the office, but I would go to the local Starbucks or coffee shop or whatever and write because I needed the action around me. So I like a little bit of noise. I like a little bit of action. Not too much noise, not too much chaos. But, you know, for me, I like to be around, you know, I can write a tremendous amount sitting down in a coffee shop and just having the activity, you know, around me. I can't work with ringing phones and answering email. I don't multitask like that, right. But I do like to be around people, and I like to have some energy around me while I'm working.
Yeah. Not that it's about me, it's about you, but I know when I was living in New York with my wife a few years back, I really excelled when I would go down to about Midtown and sit in a restaurant where there was construction and traffic, but for some reason the sound of the city energized my brain, and it made it
I wrote some great Spencer chapters. A good friend of mine has been wonderful over the years. Let me use his condo in Cambridge, and I'd go down into you know, coffee shop somewhere in Cambridge and just sit down, and the action and the, you know, you're right, the jackhammers and the noise and the people talking, and, you know, just hearing that just would always get me right in the flow of Spencer. And I love being around that. It just is the best place in the world. For me, if you gave me a, you know, solitude of a cabin on the lake or whatever, I would do absolutely nothing.
I have to admit something, Ace, I whipped my head when I read the name Philo Vance mentioned in the book and in reference to Spencer. And then upon further investigation, pun intended, I realized that you are referencing the amateur detective from the SS Van Dynes, right? Seriously.
Right.
Yeah. I'm assuming you're a big fan.
You know, I don't know those books that well, to be honest with you. I know those films, with William Powell, and I kind of came to those films through his, you know, his Nick Charles and the Thin Man films, which I love, absolutely love. And of course I love that novel as well. But yeah, no, I am familiar, but probably more familiar with the early talkies that he was Philo Vance. And, you know, that was kind of an interesting thing when I first started writing Spencer. It was kind of mentioned to me as maybe I shouldn't have such old references. Maybe I should be referencing new things, whatever. But Parker never did that. I mean, Parker easily would have mentioned Philo Vance, and that was not of his era. I mean, Parker, you know, was born in the 30s. I mean, he was just a child, a baby when these things were coming out. But he just had a love of, I think, classic Americana, whether it was detective novels or classic film or classic music or whatever. And I think that's what has contributed to the longevity of those novels, is there are cultural references and things that are just, you know, distinctly 20th century American. And that's another thing that I wanted to keep going in the books.
Yeah. And you know what, here's a compliment there. What I liked about those varied references throughout is that you, much like back to Meg Gardner, is it forces me to pick up a book or go to Wikipedia and drill down on it. And then what it does is it either reignites an old memory or it makes me research and dig further. So I actually get more of an education, as I did with this book, by just investigating some of those points.
You know, that's such a Parker thing to do, which is just to give a throwaway line of a very obscure baseball player or, a jazz artist that is seldom known, and just have a throwaway line of, you know, somebody doing this. And it does send you, what is he talking about? Of course, now it's much easier. When Bob was doing this in the 70s and 80s, you know, you really, sometimes he'd really leave you scratching your head because it wasn't easy to find out who the hell he was talking about. To the point that there was a guy that I think was a British writer, published a book about 25 years ago that was simply just the obscure references in Spencer novels. And so it's called The Spencer Companion. And so when you're reading early Spencers, it's a kind of a hard book to find, but he would have a little reference guide of exactly what the hell Bob was talking about. Now we can just Google it, but I think he really delighted at just throwing those little jokes out there. He had a very sly, very funny, very terrific, just had a wonderful sense of humor.
Yeah. Well, I'll be researching that one. The one-liners that end up being in this book that I truly adore is one of my favorite things, and which is why when you're writing the Spencer novels, I take notes constantly about particular lines that I like. And if you don't mind, I'd like to read just a couple that just had me falling on the floor.
Oh, please.
Here's one. Farrell's face turned red and he invited me back, although it appeared he'd rather eat a buffet of glass than spend more time with me. Where in the world does that come up with?
I think, I think that it goes back to, I think that type of, those little one-off lines are certainly in the spirit of Raymond Chandler. And
yeah.
Chandler had those, I'm not in any way is that, to the great level of Chandler, but I think that that's all what we're trying to go for. I think that that's what certainly got Bob influenced. There would be no Spencer without Philip Marlowe. And that world weariness is such a part of the classic detective novel. It has to be in there, and hopefully gives you a little laugh. I think that's the longevity of Chandler, and I think that's the longevity of Parker, is if it gives you a laugh and a smile, and it's not about darkness and gloom. And I think especially during these days, which have been tough on everybody, whatever, it's hard for me to read a book that doesn't make me laugh. And I think that's why, going back to our conversation earlier about Elmore Leonard, is God, you just love those books because they're so much fun. Just always would make you laugh.
Here's another one. I had to read it twice because I enjoyed it so much. One character says to Spencer, "You don't talk much, do you?" He says, "Never say anything that doesn't improve the silence." That's good enough of itself. However, Rosen said, "You always keep to that?" To which he responds, "Yeah, but it's tough. I have so many interesting things to say."
There was one of the real wonderful assets. When I first started writing Spencer, was getting to know the people in Parker's inner circle. And when Bob passed away, the people that were around him had been such a part of his team for a long time. And I meant his support team, including his Joan Parker, who became a great friend of mine and was one of the funniest women I've ever met in my life. And also a man named Mel Farman. And Mel was Bob's best friend for over 50 years. And before I would start writing a Spencer book, I'd go up there and hang out with Mel. And that sounds like something Mel would say. That's kind of that kind of edge, that kind of wry, kind of offhand humor. I think Bob and Mel used to just riff on each other at a bar. And Mel really helped kind of set that tone, I think, for the books. And I was he just recently passed away. And I was so grateful in fact, he's one of the people that the book is dedicated to. And I was so grateful to have him and Joan, who really, I think, it helped me get that tone that was right for the books.
You made a real interesting point. It's the same way I feel with Hawk, in between Spencer and Hawk. It is feels like you're eavesdropping on two guys, two good friends hanging out at a bar, just trying to one up each other with great, you know, slappy lines. All right, I'm going to do one more because the little aside sprinkled in among the scene setups and the dialogue runs are just priceless. So Glass says, "Holy hell, Spencer, does the coffee maker always make that slurping noise?" To which he responds, "Only when it's happy." And, you know, it's those moments where you're going down a trail and there's something serious happening. But back to your point, those little asides sprinkled in do something to the reader that kind of, you're getting this little momentary respite of, okay, there is humor in everything because we do that as humans, right? It isn't all just gloom and doom, et cetera. Anyway, love that.
I think going back to, again, you know, I keep on talking about the newsroom, but I think that, you know, to be able to survive in the newsroom and the newspaper back in the old days, you had to have kind of what a friend of mine called gallows humor. And I think that if you took everything in that was happening, you would just go absolutely nuts. And so you had to have those kind of moments of levity and being able to laugh at things, or you could not survive the business. And I think in the same way, you know, that Spencer exists in a world that there are some really terrible people, some really awful folks that are about doing some terrible things. You have to have something about that to keep your sanity. And I think that's a good lesson for us all.
Yeah. And along a similar line, speaking of the sexual tension, innuendo, and so forth, the playfulness between he and his girlfriend is so well done. It's just enough to tantalize because you know it's going to happen, but you don't spend any great time with it. And I kind of like that in this day and era of everybody kind of overdoing everything. And I'm a guy that, you know, has his fair share of overdoing, but there's something about that just kind of a wink and a nudge. And
I think that's all Parker, you know, that's something that I'm just kind of that's something I'm carrying over from his style and his books, which is that playful banter and that innuendo. And that's just very, very Parker-esque.
Yeah. Now, I'd like to take a second, Ace, if you don't mind, because I'm going to flash this up on the screen for my YouTube viewers. For those who would like to catch up on the series, I'd like to mention all 10 besides Bye Bye Baby. There's Someone to Watch Over Me, Angel Eyes, Old Black Magic, Little White Lies, Slow Burn, Kickback, Cheap Shot, Wonderland, and Lullaby. If you, listener, viewer, like I and like Ace, like to go back and what's the phrase you used about completion, continuation?
I can't remember. I'm sure it was a great.
Yeah, it was brilliant.
Being a completist or
that's something. It. Being a completist. If you want to be a completist like us big boys, then you want to go back and read them all. Now, I do want to ask you, I want to get on to Quinn in just a second, but my last thing is, what was your favorite thing, especially now that we know that you're going to say goodbye to Spencer, what was your favorite thing about being Spencer, and what will you miss most about him?
I think the number one thing was getting to know the people that were part of Bob's life. Getting to become friends with Joan Parker was just fantastic. She was so supportive from the beginning. Anything that I needed help, I know that I was writing the third book that was about the New England Patriots, and I needed to, you know, get over to Gillette Stadium and I needed to go see the facilities. And Joan picked up the phone, being Joan Parker in Boston, knew everybody in Boston. She got it all set up. And, you know, the next day I was at Gillette Stadium getting a, you know, first class treatment and, you know, opening doors. Joan had that type of reach in Boston, and she was so generous with her time. She was such a wonderful friend. And again, I'll mention my friend, Mel Farman. Mel, oh my gosh, you know, I would land at Logan. The first thing I would do is go meet Mel at Legal Seafood in Cambridge, which sadly isn't there anymore. And there was a little plaque on the bar where it said, "This is where Bob Parker sat along with his alter ego, Spencer." And we would just sit there and talk. And the next day we would be researching, and we would go everywhere. You know, there were certain neighborhoods where Mel would turn to me, and Mel at this time was late 70s, early 80s. And he'd say, "Kid, if you want to go there, you're on your own. you know, some rough, really rough neighborhood. You know, there were certain lines, but pretty much Mel was game to go anywhere. And so that was really the highlight. And then also getting to know the city of Boston. And I did not know Boston that well when I started writing these books. And then 10 years on, I know Boston very, very well. And I've been able to meet some wonderful people, getting to know people, the Boston Fire Department. The Boston Fire Department was so terrific when I was writing Slow Burn. I got to hang out with arson investigators, and I hung out with the commissioner and went to an arson scene. They were just, people in Boston were so generous with the fact that they knew I was writing Spencer, and he's such the Boston hero that people wanted to help. And so I will miss that. And I'll miss, you know, I miss my friends dearly that got me into this world and helped me with it. But, I hope my connection with the city of Boston will continue.
Awesome. So well done. Well, as we kind of start heading our way toward wrapping up, I do want to spend a quick minute on Quinn Colson, for crying out loud. How far into your writing were you when Quinn appeared to your subconscious? And one step further, where did he come from?
I wrote very early on when I was in my 20s, early 20s, I had this character, Nick Travers, who was, you know, kind of a, I'm from the South, and he was kind of a Southern version of, you know, very influenced by Spencer. Instead of an ex-boxer, he was an ex-football player. He lived in New Orleans. He was very New Orleans centric, you know, very, very influenced, very, very much inspired by Parker's work. And after that, I started writing books when I was older, my 30s, and really, you know, I more complex stories about true crimes that had happened. I wrote books that took place in 1950s Tampa. I wrote books that were set in 1930s America about Machine Gun Kelly, and I wrote a book about the Fatty Arbuckle scandal of 1921. And so I wrote these kind of big sprawling historical epics that were very challenging. And I said, I would never write a series ever again. I was not interested in doing a series. And so my editor, who was a wonderful, legendary editor, a guy named Neil Niren, who has edited Carl Hiaasen and John Sanford and Clive Cussler, and the list goes on and on and on. He said, Ace, you might want to think about writing a series. Mainly, you know, one of the reasons is series are very popular. And as much as I am passionate about stories that happen during the Great Depression and things like that, he said, you just can't be the contemporary crime series. He said, I really want you to think about this. So that was the reason why Quinn Colson came about. And how he came about was, I really thought about, you know, what was important to somebody like Parker, what he created a character that was very true to Boston, very true to that world. And for me, I wanted to create a character like that, that was very true to where I live in North Mississippi. And so I really concentrate on a small county. I have a character who's recently returned home from the military. A lot of it's very, very post 9/11 world. You start seeing kind of the rise of these extremists that have come in that are starting to, you know, influence this world. And I wanted to write kind of a grittier version, if this makes any sense, of the Andy Griffith Show. So if the Andy Griffith Show and Sheriff Andy had an R rating, you know, there you'd have Quinn Colson. But I've been doing those books now. I can't believe it. You know, I said I would never write another series, but after I wrote the first book, it was actually Neil Niren who put me up to write Spencer. And he was the one who mentioned, he said, I know that the Parker family wants somebody to write Spencer. So he saw things in my work, even though they were deeply Southern, very different from Bob's work, that he saw that would translate into Parker's kind of storytelling. And it was a good, great match.
Well, I love, by the way, I love your, the covers on the Quinn Colson series. They're all very similar, which is great branding. And, you know, they just have this, you know, it's the same guy with a rifle, but it doesn't matter. Each one tells this little story. And it makes me think of, and I hope this is a compliment, I love the Longmire series.
With Craig Johnson.
Craig Johnson, thank you. I was going Craig something. And it has a similar feel. And, you know, it's just that rugged Americana, no bullshit, tell it like it is. And I love that. You can't beat that.
I think there's a little, I think that it may be a little bit not exactly accurate on the covers, it does look a little bit more that way, that it's more of, you know, hell yeah, America, kick it indoors, you know, that kind of stuff. And I think there is an element to true American ideals that somebody like Quinn Colson represents. But there's a tremendous amount of discussion about the really ugly underbelly in America that's going on right now. People that are turned towards, you know, populist politics, a return to deep, of course, you know, all over the country, not just in rural Mississippi, a return to deeply racist ideas and things like that. So there's a lot of social commentary in those books. And so there's unfortunately, you know, Quinn Colson has had a lot of things to discuss, a lot of things to talk about. It reminds me very much of what Parker did in early 1970s Boston. And early 1970s Boston was not an idyllic place to be. It was rife with racism, with conflicting ideas. It's funny to think about, but at the time Parker created Spencer, the idea of having a best friend who is black in Boston was a very radical idea. And I think we're kind of used to now seeing buddy films with a team up of whites and with a white hero and a black hero, that kind of thing. But when Bob did that, it was very revolutionary. And so again, very inspired by those books, just taking that world and translating it to what's going on in the Deep South now.
Yeah. And this Bye Bye Baby, full of the racism that you mentioned. You know, I have an interesting observation, Ace, as we begin to wrap it up. And I found that when I would lay this book aside, and it took me just a couple of days to get through it, but when I would lay it aside to go do other stuff, when I returned, I hope this makes sense, I felt like I was rejoining an old friend, like when I would get together with a buddy for a beer and a conversation. And very few books do that to me, you know. I read a lot of books for the show, and then there are a lot of books I read for myself, but there are very few books that come along that impress me that way, that you're just like, wow, I can pick it back up again, and there's my pal Spencer, and let's just go through the day together.
I think that's what, again, creates or what has contributed to the longevity of this series. People connect to this character, and they, in some ways, I think he makes them feel better about living in a very ugly, sordid world. And I think what Parker did, and I think Parker did personally, and what Spencer continues to do, is say, you know, let's face it, the world is an ugly, unfair place. There are people who are morally corrupt. There is racism. There is dissension. There is greed. People are just that way. But it doesn't have to influence who I am. I can still be a moral, decent person in this very, very ugly world. And I think that type of story, that type of hero, probably means more today than ever before. And I think that's why that character will continue on, and other characters who, I think that's one of the big draws of crime fiction, which goes back to Hammett, goes back to Chandler, is somebody, you know, walking down that darkened alley and not letting them affect them. And I think that's hopefully a lesson we can all take from crime fiction.
Yeah. And this is going to seem like an odd juxtaposition, because you're talking about the darkness of crime, but I don't, and it's an admission of my own here, I don't think I've ever been as jealous of someone's quippy dialogue as I have been yours since probably Lawrence Block's Burning Rodenbark character, you're familiar.
That's a high compliment. Lawrence Block is one of our living legends, one of the absolute greats. Parker said himself what he liked about it. They said, how do you come up with that quippy lines, those great lines? And he said, Spencer is the kind of guy that comes up with the line that you think about 5 minutes later. And that's the joy of being, you know, you wish at that moment that you came up with that perfect line, and you do come up with it 5 to 10 minutes later. And that's the joy of being the writer, is we can go get a cup of coffee and come back, and that line is still available, and we still could put it in the book.
Yeah, awesome. Well, Ace, as we get to wrap things up here, we do this one thing called a rapid-fire questions. Really quite harmless. It's not going to hurt at all. And it's just to kind of get stuff off the top of your head, if you still got another minute or two.
Of course.
What is one gadget or tool that you just simply can't live without?
bottle opener.
Nice. Beef or pork ribs on the barbecue?
Oh man, that's a tough one. I mean, I'm from around Memphis. I got to say pork.
Yeah, ditto. Hush puppies or fries?
Both.
Okay. If you weren't a New York Times bestselling author, what do you think you'd be doing?
I would be an out-of-work journalist.
Okay. I saw your interview with William Shoot the Moonlight Out Boyle, a top 10 favorite read of my 2021, by the
terrific
way.
Terrific book.
God, such a good book. You two were sipping bourbon on a front porch and Zooming with a friend. So my question is, favorite, beer or bourbon?
I'd have to, again, go to both.
Not fair, but I'm going to let it. All right. If you could start, this one I really love, especially since I did a little bit of homework on you. If you could star in a movie, and I know you said you weren't an actor, but let's pretend you are, because I think you got the chutzpah to do it. Would you rather act alongside Clint Eastwood in The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, or alongside Dennis Weaver in the Spielberg classic Duel?
Oh, wow. It would be hard to pass up. If the role is the evil truck driver, I would say Duel.
What a fun character, right?
Absolutely.
One of my all-time favorite movies. Come on, Good, Bad, and the Ugly. Ugh.
If I could take you on a tour of my house, I have an original movie poster of The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly in my kitchen that's from the original release, and it is one of my, it's one of those films that gets better every time you watch it.
Oh my God, how did you find that?
We could have a separate conversation about movie memorabilia, but outside books, that's one of my passions is collecting movie memorabilia, up to the point where my wife has put a cap on eBay purchases. But I do love classic film, and particularly of that era, the 1960s, 1960s Westerns. Love it.
Oh, lucky you. Okay, last question, Ace. If you could sit down and have a beer and or bourbon or both with one person, whom you've never met, alive or otherwise, who would it be and why?
I think probably we would, going back to Spencer and to Parker and what I do and what he did and whatever, is I would have liked to have hung out with Raymond Chandler. I think Chandler, I don't know how his mood would have been on that particular day, but I think his worldview has influenced so much of what I did and what Parker's done that I would have loved to. I've read his letters, and I think he would have been, maybe not always pleasant, but he would have been very entertaining to hang out with.
Superb answer. Well, Ace Atkins, I can't tell you how much fun this was and how honored I am that you've been here. So thank you for carving time out for us.
Please,
on the Thriller Zone.
My pleasure. So much fun. And thanks for having me on. I really had a great time.
Folks, if you'd like to know anything more, go to aceatkins.com, and there's Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. So you can be pretty much found everywhere, can't you, buddy?
All that stuff, except for TikTok. I draw the line.
Oh, I'd like to see you.
No, that's never going to happen.
No.
Never, ever, ever will happen.
All right, Ace, once again, thank you so much.
Hey, my pleasure. Thanks, Dave.
Thanks so much to Ace Atkins for joining us on the Thriller Zone. So much fun. We learned a lot. Elmore Leonard, one of my all-time lifetime heroes, and he got to build a relationship and a friendship with him. That is so cool. All right. Hey, listen, let me do this because we're doing it on the fly. Next week, on next Thursday's show, I've got Andrews Wilson. These guys are writing machines, the dynamic duo writing machines. We're going to talk about all their books, the faith-based books, the action books, the military books, what they've got coming. Movies in the making? Don't know. You'll have to tune in to find out. So much stuff jammed into January, I couldn't be happier. Thank you once again. And do me a favor, stop by thethrillerzone.com, leave us a review. Leave us some comments, sign up if you'd like to be on the show, and of course go over to YouTube at youtube.com/DavidTempleAuthor. Yes, I'm still trying to get 100 subscribers, and we can change that to the Thriller Zone. Thanks, YouTube. But do me a favor and just swing on by subscribe, hit the bell, all that good stuff, to stay tuned to more in January and the year to come in season 2. I'm David Temple. We'll see you next time on The Thriller Zone.